Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I am on the phone with Thane Curry and Carol Grady, astronomers at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Thane and Carol are co-authors of our August issue cover story about Lick Calcium 15, a young star whose surrounding disk seems to be producing a planetary system very similar to our own solar system. Thane and Carol, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
When did astronomers first take notice of Lick Calcium 15 as a potentially very interesting system?
Well, it's been followed as a very young star since the 1980s. But as technology has advanced and we have access to higher angular resolution data and high contrast imaging data, it has become progressively more and more interesting.
So the evidence has just gradually accumulated over time, where showing that not only does the star have a disk surrounding it, but that it has a disk showing evidence for a hole or a gap devoid of small dust, and this showing evidence for a planet.
You mentioned in the article that Lick Calcium 15, the star itself, is somewhere between 1 and 5 million years old, and it has about 0.97 times the mass of the sun. So it's like it'll eventually evolve into a star very similar to the sun. How do we know the age and mass of this star?
So, well, first of all, we can compare the luminosity and the temperature of the star to what are called pre-main sequence evolutionary tracks that basically try to track how bright a star is as a function of time. Because we also know that Lick Calcium 15 resides within a young star-forming region, we can compare the range of luminosity and temperatures of these stars to these models in order to estimate the age of this star.
How much mass is in the disk, and how do we know that?
Okay, so we have observations of Lick Calcium 15 in the submillimeter. And the emission at these wavelengths are optically thin. And what we can do then is that we can estimate the mass of dust in this system. And assuming a gas-to-dust ratio, we can then estimate the mass of gas in the system. And these estimates imply that Lick Calcium 15 still is surrounded by a very massive disk. So if we took all the solar system's planets and grinded them up together, put it all into one big pot, it would equal roughly the mass of the Lick Calcium 15 disk times several, meaning that the Lick Calcium 15 disk is actually fairly massive. And so we can sort of understand intuitively that this is the kind of site that we would expect to find a massive planet forming, because it had enough material there to begin with.
The article talks about the fact that we really don't have a very precise mass determination of the planet. It's probably at least the mass of Jupiter, but it could be considerably more massive. Are there any immediate prospects for determining the mass of the planet and perhaps helping us learn more about the physical nature of the planet?
Well, I think that this is going to be very difficult. First of all, even if Lick Calcium 15b looked like a normal directly imaged planet, or rather like an unresolved point source like we see with other directly imaged planets, it would still be very difficult. And that is because the models used to translate between the brightness of the planet and its mass are very uncertain at extremely young ages, right after the planet has formed. So that is one serious problem. And in addition to that, the appearance of Lick Calcium 15b implies that it is actively accreting gas. And so you have luminosity coming from this infalling material. And we understand the physics of that process not very well either. And so we're really kind of an uncharted territory here.
That's what makes it fun. Now, part of the problem is we don't have a clear view yet of the underlying planet. And I'm sure that people will be trying to reobserve this system again and again and again to try and get that clear view of the underlying planet that will then help in tandem with similar observations of other systems to actually pin what the luminosity of planet is as opposed to the luminosity of the material accreting onto it. So this is essentially a work in progress.
Your article also mentions the strong possibility that there could be additional planets orbiting Lick Calcium 15. What are the prospects for imaging additional planets, assuming they exist?
There are several ways in which you could try to do this. You could try to use the same kind of techniques that had been used to image the planet that we know about, namely non-redundant masking. You can also try with a new generation of planet imagers going on telescopes like Gemini or Subaru. Because the technology gain that we get with these new planet imagers is such a big increase over what we have now, we may actually be able to see qualitatively different things, namely young planets at very small separations that we couldn't see before. So who knows?
Well, the other thing is, it's been recognized for some time that the size of the holes in these disks are far too large to be being swept by a single planet. And so there almost certainly are other bodies residing within the disk of Lick Calcium 15 and likely many other similar sorts of disks. And the goal will be to try and pick these things up.
So Carol, you would agree that we've only just started to be able to look for these planets. We've just scratched the surface.
Yes. We're basically, with these sorts of young planets, we are where discovery of radial velocity exoplanets was in 1995 and 1996. We know they're out there. We know there are many of them. We are just starting to find them. And this is particularly interesting because up until now, we've had theoretical simulations that have suggested what should be happening with planet formation. We've had studies of some of the minor planets in our solar system to look at solid bodies, things that never got to the mass range to be able to accumulate a gaseous atmosphere. But we have not been able to see all of this happening in real time, which is what makes a lot of this very exciting, because of the gas in some of these systems. These giant planets are still capable of moving around in their disks, and we suspect that some of them may end up being very close-in planets, but others may not. And so it's nice to have sort of a before and after shot.
And that actually leads me right into the next question I was planning to ask, and that is, you know, we look at these exoplanetary systems and we see a huge diversity of architectures. We've got, you know, some systems with massive planets in close, and then you have other systems where the giant planets are much farther out. We've got systems that are, they're kind of all bunched up close to the star. Others like our solar system where things seem more widely separated. What's the latest thinking in the astronomical community these days about why we're seeing such a wide range of architectures in planetary systems?
There are a couple of ideas. One, it appears that the mass of the star clearly matters. And the implication there is that, you know, around more massive stars, you expect more massive disks, and so you have a lot more raw material from which to form planets. And even some small change in the mass of the disk may have a huge impact in the kinds of planetary systems that you form. Another thing that may be important may be the initial angular momentum of the disk, or the initial physical extent of the disk. And a lot of it may actually just be stochastic. So, for example, if you had a couple proto-Jupiters form, or namely, you know, a 5 to 10 Earth mass core form, and one of them gets to that point faster than the others, it may kick out the other cores and may toss them out to wider separations, and where they end up becoming gas giants at those locations. And if that doesn't happen, if they never reached quite that mass, we could just have, you know, failed planetary systems. There's a huge range of possible outcomes here. And we have some ideas for what matters, but quantifying that and having a good predictive model for that is something that we're still working on.
Yeah. This is work at the frontiers of astronomy, and we know some of the questions to start asking at this point, but we certainly do not have all of the answers yet.
Where do you think this field is going to be 5 years from now?
In 5 years, we will have a bunch of new tools at our disposal that will let us tackle a wide range of systems. The other thing is that Kepler will have a longer baseline and will be also sampling less frequent transits from planets that are much farther out in some of the systems that they've been following. So I think that in 5 to 10 years, we will have a much better idea of just raw frequency of planets, and we will start to have a sample where we can look at young planets and start to ask the question, are they where they end up eventually? Are their locations very different? Mm-hmm. And then it will be a matter for the theorist to try and understand how you get from point A to point B.
Yeah, I agree. I also think, too, that we'll have a lot more information that will give us a good idea of the physical properties of these planets. We'll be able to understand in much more detail some of these processes and how the atmosphere of a planet, how the size of a planet changes as a function of time. The current knowledge that we have suggests that our initial guesses as to the structures of these atmospheres weren't terribly good, at least for the directly imaged planets. So there's been a lot of work in trying to understand the atmospheric properties of planets like HR8799. And then also we have similar studies on other planet mass companions. And there's been a huge amount of literature on this, on only just one system. So imagine multiplying that times 5 or 10 or 15 or however many planets we directly image in the next 5 years.
That was all the questions that I had, but I wanted to ask if you had anything else that you'd like to discuss that I have not asked you about.
Well, I would just like to reinforce the idea that, you know, this is a field of science that didn't exist 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, a lot of the science that you study in high school or in college is, you know, was developed in the 19th century, 17th century, 18th century. But this is an area of science I think that is particularly exciting to me because we're watching it being created, watching it being developed right before our eyes.
Yeah, that's the reason I enjoy working in this area, because every day it's, what are we going to find? What's new? What's happening? And this is actually, because these are planets, these are ultimately places where people are going to be looking at chemistry. They're going to be looking at planetary surfaces. And ultimately, these are systems, or at least some of them are systems, where we will want to look for evidence for life. I think this is going to be the part of astronomy that is the real growth field for the 21st century. And we have only begun.
Well, that sounds great. As a journalist, this has been incredible to cover. And I mean, I remember back in the late 90s, every time there was a new planet, you know, we'd have to cover it, you know, a new planet discovered. And now it's a case where you really need something special about a planet, you know, something that produces a really new insight for the media really to, you know, to want to cover it. But I think that's actually illustrative of just the incredible rate of progress that has been made. So I want to say I really appreciate your time speaking to me today, and also for writing the article for Sky and Telescope.
Thank you.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a pleasure.